Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When in Rome, do as the Romans, right? President Obama played tourist today in the Eternal City. We, however, will check in on how the continent is feeling about Crimea. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 27th of March. Good as always to have you with us. President Obama's tour of Europe continued today after spending the first half of the week on Ukraine and Crimea. He was in Rome this morning. The president was visiting with the Pope and taking a tour of the Colosseum. The International Monetary Fund, meanwhile, has prepared an $18 billion aid package for Ukraine, and the U.S. Congress has voted to chip in another even $1 billion. So we are going to start today just because it's been a little while with a relatively simple question. Now that the sanctions are in place and nobody seems to be ready to change their minds on this thing.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? We start in Warsaw, Poland, with John Beacham of Polski Radio. John, it's good to talk to you.
Hi there.
First of all, what's the mood? What are people saying about all this? It's been a while since we've heard from Europe.
Well, to be honest with you, there's not too much cause for alarm here in Poland. Of course, Prime Minister Tusk has repeatedly said that we're all safe and that everything is absolutely fine. This has also been reiterated by Poland's Foreign Minister, Radosław Sikorski. Poles do have this historical baggage, which means that, you know, any time that Russia does get up to something, you know, Poles do get a little bit nervous. But on the whole, it's business as usual.
Speaking of business, is the economy feeling it at all? I mean, can you, you know, is it tangible?
It certainly is. I mean, in the first 3 months, so from January to mid-March, I mean, we had a 7.3% year-on-year drop in exports to Russia. We've had, in the same period, a 6.3% year-on-year drop to Ukraine. I mean, these sound like small figures, but I mean, we're talking about one-fifth of Poland's exports. So yeah, we're going to be feeling the pinch.
I'm going to use an Americanism here, and hopefully you'll understand what I mean. Do Poles feel that the Germans with a bigger economy and the Brits to some degree and the United States, do you guys feel that everybody else has your back when it comes to this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it depends whether you're talking about politically or economically. I mean, obviously, Germany, in terms of trade, Germany is Poland's biggest trading partner. And I think the Germans realize this. So Poland is to be reckoned with in this respect.
John Beacham with Polskie Radio in Warsaw. John, thank you so much.
No problem. Glad to be on the show.
From Warsaw, we head due west to Berlin, Germany, and reporter Thomas Marzel. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Kai.
Give me a sense, would you, first of all, of the vibe, I guess is the word, after this Russia and Crimea thing.
I think people are certainly discussing it because, I mean, when it comes to pocketbook issues, that's always on people's minds. And Germans have seen their energy bills skyrocket over the last couple of years, even as sometimes worldwide energy prices have fallen. And so any sanctions that might be put on the Russian energy industry might actually end up hitting the Germans in their pocketbooks, and that wouldn't be pretty.
Do you think Germans are willing to deal with that or no?
Now that some of the sanctions have started to ramp up and started to kick in, there's been a shift, a slow shift among public sentiment. The question is, if a pollster would actually ask the question, okay, so do you support sanctions on Russia, on the energy sector, and other areas that could affect German jobs, they might answer yes. If your energy bill goes up by 25% in 6 months, maybe not so much.
Are people over there happy with, satisfied with Angela Merkel and Germany sort of being the point person on this for the Europeans with the Russians? It very much seems like you guys are, you know, you guys are the big stick over there, sort of.
We definitely are the big stick. I mean, no matter what David Cameron and François Hollande and the other leaders
don't tell them.
Say, don't tell them. No, definitely not. I mean, I think it's kind of like this is the role that Germany is playing, and that's the shape of things to come as we move forward here in Europe.
Thomas Marzel, we got him in Berlin. Thomas, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Elsewhere in the global economy, as of earlier today, a couple hours ago, you could download a version of Microsoft Office for your iPad. Big news in the tech world, yes, and yet somehow something Microsoft had resisted for years. Marketplace's David Gura has that one.
Windows debuted in 1985, and because of that operating system, Microsoft was sitting pretty through the 90s. Rosabeth Moss Cantor is a professor at Harvard Business School.
They could then control it in every way, but the world changes, and the innovations came from other places.
Well, from one in particular. Ed McGuire is an analyst with CLSA.
Apple understood that the market was evolving from just selling products to selling a full experience.
And Microsoft wanted to duplicate that with its software, Office, and its hardware, the Surface tablet. But McGuire says a closed system works best when you're first out of the gate, like Microsoft was in the 80s with Windows, and like Apple was more recently with iPods, iPhones, and iPads. Colin Gillis is with BGC Financial, and he says Microsoft's finally come to this conclusion.
We need to participate before the market moves beyond us too much.
This has happened before. Closed systems have given way to open systems. Unix was eclipsed by Linux. And sometimes closed systems give way to cooperation among former competitors. That's what happened with Java. Gillis says today's announcement speaks to a broader trend.
It's always going to be a battle between closed and open systems, but certainly in terms of market share, open systems win.
Just look at the fight between the iPhone, which is part of a closed system, he says, and the Android operating system, which is an open one. Almost four-fifths of the smartphones in use around the world run Android. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, a whole lot of meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Six million people, that's the tally out today from the White House for health insurance signups under the Affordable Care Act. The somewhat fungible deadline, as we've mentioned before, is this coming Monday, the 31st of March, and officials are bracing for a flood of signups in the next couple of days. But they are worried about getting enough of the right signups. Latinos in particular, they tend to be younger and, more to the point, healthier than the general population. And states with the biggest concentrations of Latinos have been struggling to win them over. From KQED in San Francisco, April Dimboski explains what went wrong in California.
Many Latinos are afraid that if they sign up for health insurance, their undocumented family members will get discovered and deported. Others aren't convinced it's worth the money. People like Larissa Bobadilla are out trying to convince them that it's okay.
I think they trust me.
They trust her because she's been on the streets of Los Angeles for 16 years working as a promotora, a health outreach worker. Now, the kids of people she helped years ago are coming to her to find out what's really going on with Obamacare.
The news give a lot of information. They confuse to the people and they don't know what is the truth.
Bobadilla is exactly the kind of person California officials want on the streets selling health plans. The trouble is, the state is short thousands of these insurance counselors. Political wrangling at the federal level is partly to blame. That delayed the rollout of programs for training counselors. And that left no time to approve a Spanish training curriculum or a Spanish certification test. Bobadilla was lucky. She had enough English to get by.
I don't know. I'm feeling so nervous. I'm feeling so frustration.
But other promotoras in her community didn't pass the test, and they can't help anybody until they do. This shortage of people power isn't just limited to the streets.
Gracias por llamar a Cover California.
The state insurance exchange underestimated how many counselors it would need to staff its call centers. Many people who asked to speak to somebody in Spanish got transferred to English-speaking agents. And when there are too many calls, the system hangs up.
Adios.
Similar problems have plagued the website. In the Bay Area community of San Pablo, Maria Aurelia got stuck trying to sign up online.
Yo lo visité con ayuda de mi hermano.
I visited the website with my brother's help, and we tried to enroll, but it didn't work. I would much rather sign up face-to-face. There's more communication.
These disasters in customer service are the main reason Latino enrollment has been so far below expectations. But there's another hurdle: cost. Many plans run $200-$300 a month. Maria Aurelia says she would prefer a monthly payment of $100 for her family. Same with construction worker Jose Rodriguez.
Good price, $100 a month.
Research shows that only a quarter of Latinos are willing to pay more than $100 a month for health insurance. Carlos Santiago runs the Hispanic market research group Santiago Solutions.
You kind of go, wait a minute, am I really going to use this right away? How much do I need that security right now, this year, when I have all these other realities in my life?
The deadline to sign up is March 31st. This late in the game, there's not much any state can do about the prices. In San Francisco, I'm April Dymbosky for Marketplace.
Bad news today for those who like to kill time in airports browsing in a Brookstone store. There is word via the Wall Street Journal that the company, purveyor of massage chairs, memory foam slippers, and robotic pets, is on the skids, getting ready to file for bankruptcy is another way to say that. There are also apparently talks underway for Brookstone to sell itself to another novelty palace from the past, Spencer's, home of the whoopee cushion, lava lamp, and other teenage must-haves. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on the business of selling us what we somehow want but don't really need.
If you haven't been in a Brookstone in a while, here's what you're missing. Indoor-outdoor wireless speakers, remote control stunt helicopters, and the deluxe Bluetooth body-scanning U-Divine massage chair for $4,600.
I think that's just it. You know, not a lot of people need the novelty stuff.
They sure like to check it out, though. I found electrical engineer Kurt Stanfield at the mall in Towson, Maryland, eyeing a $60 remote control car on his lunch break.
I think, you know, especially, you know, if the economy's down or if people are trying to be wise with their money, then they're probably not going to be shopping in a place like Brookstone. There's nifty things, you know, but it's not somewhere where I'm going to be taking my money.
Brookstone didn't get back to us for comment, but the journal reports sagging sales and heavy debt are behind the bankruptcy filing. Rajiv Lal teaches retailing at Harvard Business School. He says many stores are fighting the same battle. People try something out and then buy online.
Many times they would find something comparable at much lower prices. And that's what becomes so difficult for stores like Brookstone to be able to close a sale.
Lal is working on a book called Will Your Retail Store Survive? Spencer's apparently thinks Brookstone will. The journal reports the company has no current plans to close stores or cut staff. And Spencer's has a history of reinvention. It started as a mail order business in the 40s, moved to the mall in the 60s, and now makes a lot of its money from Spirit Halloween and its pop-up costume stores. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This is, I will tell you, one of those very rare days when I wished radio came with pictures attached. Yes, insert television joke here, but seriously, I'm talking about the waffle taco, which debuted today from Taco Bell. It is, amazingly, just what it sounds like, a breakfast sandwich, one part waffle, one part taco, and three parts marketing. Truth is, though, that at this point, funky food combinations aren't really that funky anymore. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore bites into the world of food mashups. Mashups! In music, they can be amazing. In science fiction, usually not.
It's alive, it's alive!
In food,
bacon and milkshake, quadruple burgers, a waffle taco.
Darren Tristano is with food industry research group Technomic.
If you want to put beer and milk together, you can go to Red Robin and get a Samuel Adams beer milkshake.
That sounds really horrific, actually.
It's been a huge success, believe it or not.
And Tristano says, it's official. This is a trend.
We are seeing quite a bit of more indulgent, more interesting, and more innovative items coming out, especially from fast food.
Using chicken breasts as buns, bacon with donuts, Dos Equis margarita-flavored beer. If these chimeras could speak, they might ask their creators, why?
What's driving it right now is that the quick service restaurant industry as a whole is not growing. The packaged food business, for the most part, is not growing.
Gary Steibel is with the New England Consulting Group.
The need for innovation is critical right now.
Even if a new product doesn't take off, and most don't, it still creates buzz, says RJ Hadavi. He's a restaurant analyst with Morningstar.
If you shorten the product cycle and come out with new flavors that are only going to be a limited time thing, you effectively encourage a more frequent trial by consumers.
And there is another ingredient to this trend, millennials. They like new things. So, that's what they're getting. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace. I'm sorry, Sam Adams beer milkshake? I don't think so. But I digress. Coming up,
The hope is that in the short run, they're equipping their students to do things other than be caught in just the low-end minimum wage trap.
Future jobs on our series, American Futures. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 4 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 16,264. The NASDAQ continued its swoon, down 22 points, 0.5%, 4,151. The S&P 500 took off 3 points, 0.1%, ended things at 1849. Big banks got a reminder of the financial crisis and its after effects today. The Fed told Citigroup it couldn't buy back shares and issue a dividend to shareholders until it revised its capital plan. Citigroup down 5% on the news. Tech investors still are not interested in Candy Crush on its second day of trading. King Digital stock fell another 2.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for February. Grab your popcorn and your Dramamine and both your dogs. Noah sails to the big screen. And Lady Gaga turns 28. Did you know that there is a Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of Lady Gaga impersonators? That would be 121 impersonators at the 2011 Grammys. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've got a collaboration going with our partners at the BBC, looking at the global problem of obesity. Here in the States, one big issue is getting healthy foods to people, especially in what are called food deserts, neighborhoods often poor, that don't have big supermarkets and thus don't have great access to fresh produce. Residents tend to have much higher rates of obesity and diabetes and other health problems, which has officials looking for answers. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
On a sunny morning in Boyle Heights, a mostly Latino neighborhood in East Los Angeles, dozens of TV news cameras and city officials crowd the sidewalk in front of a corner store. A sign reads, "Todo lo que necesita," everything you need. Dr. Eric Walsh, a public health official in a dark blue suit, steps up to a podium and adjusts the microphone. Next to him is a table covered with brightly colored packages of tobacco products and sweetened alcohol drinks.
Well, I want to start by just saying we ought to take pause and ask a very difficult and hard question. Who do these products really target? Why are they in the neighborhoods that they're in? In fact, what we face today is a question about the new civil rights in America. That there are corporations and practices out there that are targeting the poorest, most vulnerable, least resourced people in our community, the blackest, the brownest. So we have a responsibility in public health to step up and address this.
The purpose of this news conference is to announce the results of a California statewide survey, the first of its kind. Researchers visited more than 7,000 grocery stores, everything from a small neighborhood bodega to big box stores. The survey looked at how tobacco, alcohol, and junk food are marketed in California. The data showed that nearly three-quarters of the stores carried alcohol, while just over a third sold milk, and more than half did not carry fresh produce. The survey also found that unhealthy products were more prevalent and more heavily marketed in poor neighborhoods. The news conference was held in front of the Euclid Market because it's one of the corner stores participating in a market makeover project, sponsored by UCLA and USC. Store owners get their store remodeled for free if they agree to offer healthy products and take down ads for tobacco, alcohol, and junk food. Before the makeover, the windows of the store were plastered with ads.
Bonito.
The store is beautiful now. Removing the ads from the windows brought more natural light into the store and more life.
Avila's also seen a slight uptick in sales, but not everyone is convinced that these makeovers are good for business. I talked to another corner store owner just a few blocks away. He was going to participate in the market makeover project, but then he changed his mind. He makes most of his money selling beer and junk food, and he wasn't convinced that people would buy produce even if he offered it. And he's right. Stocking shelves with produce is only part of the effort to get people to eat healthy. They have to be motivated to buy it.
Most of the people that we're working with are either food stamp recipients or food stamp eligible people, people that are under the poverty level of 185%.
Mary Otetra Garcia runs the Nutrition and Physical Activity Program in Pasadena. She teaches classes on health and nutrition in a working-class neighborhood with few places to buy healthy food.
I always tell people, whatever your cultural food is, it's okay to have that, because the more American diet that they adopt or their children adopt, the unhealthier they get. So we already know studies have shown that people that come from other countries are healthier than the people that are here.
Carl Walton was a student in the class. He's not from another country. He was born here. But when he started changing his diet, he did his grocery shopping across town at the Whole Foods.
I started at Whole Foods, but then it trickled down to Trader Joe's. Then it trickled down to Food for Less and everywhere else I can afford. If we had better things set up in our neighborhoods, that would be the counter to what's put out here for us.
Nearly all the restaurants in this part of town are fast food, mostly fried chicken and burger joints, a few small Mexican places. But I did find a place to get fresh fruit. From a little cart run by Alejandro Beltran, he sells mango, pineapple, cucumber, and coconut, sliced and sprinkled with lime and chile. Salt, too, if that's your fancy. He says business is pretty good. These carts are all over poor neighborhoods.
I sell to all social classes and different races. Latinos, Asians, Americans.
Beltran pulled a chunk of pineapple from his cart and sliced it in half with his knife. Everyone, he says, eats fruit. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Today, it seems, is the day on this program for long absent stings, those short little audio elements that let you know what's coming. First, what's up, Europe? And now this.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, got Tango for landing.
It has been honestly too long since we've caught up with Jim Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic, about the project we've got going with him and his wife, Deb. American Futures is what it's called. The Fallows fly about the country in their own small plane, landing where they like and seeing what they can see. We get to go with them every now and then, finding slices of America and the American economy. Jim, it's good to talk to you again.
Kai, thank you very much.
It's been a while, so why don't we catch people up? Where have you and Deb been in the past couple of weeks and months?
Well, for a while, we were marooned in D.C. by these endless snowstorms, which have gotten me sick yet again. But then we spent about 2 weeks in southern Georgia and northern Florida. And then very recently, while my plane has been getting its annual maintenance that you know all about, we've been in the Central Valley of California, which we'll talk to you about another time, just thinking about some of the challenges there.
Right, right. Well, give me, as we've talked about, this series is a series of slices of life in America and the American economy. So what slice have you discovered as you've been out and about?
A slice that has impressed us recently involves a role of education that I had not known about or at least thought about before we've been traveling to a lot of these smaller towns.
Right.
And essentially, it's the part of American education that gets least discussed, which is the vocational or job training aspect of it.
Oh, yeah. It's a thing we don't like to talk about much, right?
That's right. It seems to me that most discussion of education is either at the high end where, of course, our universities are still dominant and we worry whether that will continue, or the low end where we have understandable worries about sort of basic literacy for a lot of students. But the part of education that prepares people for actual jobs, including those that are hardest to outsource and are not just low-wage sort of entry-level jobs, that's something we seem to act as if only the Germans or the Icelanders or the Japanese will pay attention to that. But that's – we've seen a number of cases of this.
All right. Well, pick your favorite and give me an example.
Well, the one that's on my mind right now is Camden County High School in the very southern southeastern tip of Georgia. It's close to the cities of St. Mary's and Kingsland and Woodbine. What's interesting about this school is it's famous in the rest of Georgia as a football powerhouse. It's a gigantic school. It's the entire county, and so they have a big population to draw from. And
Friday Night Lights, baby. Yeah.
Exactly. And the weight room is something that would be the envy of many NFL teams. But what was amazing to us is the way they have organized themselves into a series of academies whose main purpose is to train people who might not be going on to advanced college degrees for good jobs.
Give me some examples. I mean, these academies, what are they like?
Well, one of the academies is for government service and public service and things of that sort. And there's a big law enforcement emphasis there. There's a man named Rich Gamble who worked for a long time as an NCIS investigator at a nearby naval base. And he trains the kids to do mock forensic and criminal work. His students wear these white lab coats and they go through the school and they stage some kind of mock crime. Then the rest of the students, they take plaster casts of the footprints and they take statements from witnesses and they prepare court documents. And so this is the idea is to prepare people for this kind of skill in public or private work.
Not to cast aspersions on South Georgia in any way, but are there enough jobs that these kids are trained for in that area to keep them there, or do they wind up leaving town?
Well, a lot of them do end up leaving, and this is an ironic challenge that this school system and area seems to have compared with many others. In lots of places, you will have jobs, but they don't seem to have well enough trained people to fill them. them. Yeah. In Camden County, Georgia, their pride is generating students who are prepared for lots of jobs in medical care or in public service or whatever, with not enough jobs in the region. So they feel as if they're supplying, as one teacher told me, they're supplying all of Florida from Georgia and of course, other parts of the country. So the hope is that in the short run, they're equipping their students to do things other than be caught in just the low-end minimum wage trap.
Right.
And in the longer run, they're hoping this will equip them to develop some industry there to employ their own people.
James Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. The series we do with him and his wife is called American Futures. There's more of it on our website, which is marketplace.org, also on The Atlantic's website. Jim, thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which Twitter tries to get back into the music game. Its music app was pulled from the iTunes store yesterday, a failure by most accounts. So today, this news that Twitter and Billboard are going to release something called the Billboard Twitter Real-Time Charts, which will be a continuously updated list of the music that is being tweeted in the United States, which I get, but also why? Right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.